You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Daniel. And somewhere, Lionel, are you there? Lionel Burney.
Hello, chaps.
A hand, a disembodied hand waves on this on the tiny screen. Hello, Lionel. Is there any reason why your camera is pointing at the ceiling?
I can't conceal his location.
Can't prop my phone up. It keeps slipping down, so you can look at the spotlight on my ceiling.
Thanks very much. No musical revelations this week, I'm afraid. Daniel's back in his black polo neck, looking kind of 007 like Daniel, appropriately enough. He's in a secret location. Well, listen, this is our penultimate episode before Christmas, isn't it? We've got a very special one planned for next week. Details probably follow next week. While I remember as well, there will be an episode of Service Course as well before Christmas. Lizzie Banks and Tom Wally, and they're stealing our press conference concept. And they're asking for tech questions, any equipment questions, clothing, anything at all related to the bike. Send us in your questions, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, an audio file. I think Daniel might have one.
I did actually have a question.
Go on then.
I don't know if you saw pictures flying around online of, I think it's a Dutch company that's designed some handlebars that are very, very narrow.
Yes.
I don't know how... Why they are maybe 20 centimetres, 30
centimetres. They've got this long, straight section before the brake levers, don't they?
Yeah, they're a bit of a hybrid between a time trial bar and normal road handlebars. Want to know, is this the future? And how soon is the future going to arrive in the Pro Tour, in the World Tour in this form?
Dan Bigham had quite a robust exchange on that with people who didn't like the aesthetics of it. I would include myself among those people. Basically arguing that aesthetics irrelevant. It's all about performance, and it's a performance sport. So forget the aesthetics. I don't know. I'm not sure I'd go along with that, Dan, if I'm honest. But the UCI are there as custodians of the aesthetics and everything else and the purity of the sport.
It's funny, Rich. I was reading an interview with Dario Cataldo, veteran Movistar, he rides for now, Italian rider, the other day. And he was talking about how it's quite a subject of conversation among older riders in the peloton and how equipment and advances in equipment are making races too fast. I don't know how you gauge. I don't know what prompted him to decide what the threshold was. But he said that he's even had conversations with colleagues about, you know, how the UCI should further restrict, not just in terms of weight, but restrict aerodynamics on bikes. It sort of reminded me of the conversation that's been going on for years in golf about distances or the golf ball flies and how it makes it impossible to adapt courses to that. I mean, of course, in cycling, there's no reason
speed
why
limit.
Average
there's
speeds
no
shouldn't be 70 kilometers an hour. I mean, we tried that in the 90s, and I think everyone enjoyed it.
I mean, if it's too fast, it's probably maybe time to retire. But on that, I think we're gonna be talking in this week's episode a bit about Team Sunweb and their new sponsor for next year. And we might hear a little bit from Mark Hershey, might we, Lionel? You were part of his press conference. But Mark Hershey, thumbs down, we're not going to hear from Mark Hershey, but we will hear from Nicholas Roach and Ivan Speckenbrink, who's the man in charge there. And I had a few messages from people during the tour about Hershey and the position that he adopted on the bike using his device, which was a very large device mounted at the front of the handlebars as a sort of improvised tri-bar setup. People wondering whether that was a kind of hack, that was a kind of way around the rules, basically, almost like Spinaches, but being able to adopt that position, have some security in that position by virtue of the device at the front of his handlebars. But we're going down a bit of a rabbit hole here, aren't we? It feels like silly season in cycling. There's been an awful lot of news this last week, big news as well. So maybe we should get straight into the news roundup, because we do have a few interviews in this week's episode. Lionel.
Well, that's the opposite of silly season, isn't it? Silly season is traditionally the August, isn't it, in newspaper
all
world,
right,
where
sorry.
Very little going,
silly,
very little going
silly
on.
Silly season police there. So,
It's incredibly serious season this week with all the news that's going about. You mentioned we've got an episode of Service Course coming up in the next couple of weeks. We've also got an episode of Explore coming out later this week. Daniel, you might be interested. Do you remember Timmy Mallett? I've interviewed Timmy Mallett.
Wow.
I
name-checked him a few
Whackaday.
Weeks ago, didn't I?
British children's TV star of the late 80s and 90s. A big cycling fan and has cycled halfway across Western Europe, written a book about it as well. He is the subject of Explore. That will be out later this week. And also, Richard, the first of the two-part Friends of the Podcast episode that we won't spoiler by revealing now what it's about, but it's an absolute cracker.
Oh, yeah, it's brilliant. Just thinking, Velon are missing a trick, aren't they, not getting Timmy Mallett to be an ambassador of the Hammer series?
With his mallet's mallet.
Yeah, exactly.
This won't make sense to anyone who didn't watch Whackaday or Mallet's Mallet in the 90s, but all will be revealed on Explore. But Rich, crack on with the news, shall we? Because several of these things we're going to talk about in this episode. First of all, Mark Cavendish is returning to De Koninck Quickstep. He rode for them from 2013 to 2015 when they were Omega Pharma Quickstep and then Etics Quickstep. He won 44 races for them, including three Tour de France stages, and he goes back there after a year with Bahrain McLaren. Sticking with Bahrain McLaren, or rather not sticking with Bahrain McLaren, is Rod Ellingworth, who is going back as well. He's going to Ineos Grenadiers as director of racing. We'll talk about those two big moves in part one of the podcast. You mentioned Sunweb, Richard. I wonder how long it will be before I get my head around their new name.
I would say 2023.
Maybe. Well, Team DSM, they're going to be sponsored primarily by a Dutch-based multinational science company that has interests in nutrition, health and sustainability. And they've got a new blue jersey with two pale blue stripes on it, kind of keeping that design from the Sunweb jersey, which was obviously white with the two black stripes on it, but reversing it and adding some rather Team Sky-like pale blue stripes. But so they will be Team DSM. Must try and remember that. Maybe I'll write out 1,000 times Team DSM until it lodges in my brain. We're also going to hear from Sherry Pridham, who will become the first woman to work as a sports director in the World Tour. She is joining Israel Startup Nation at the start of next season. She's been a sports director for over a decade with Plowman Craven Madison, Team Rally, and most recently the Vitus team, which she also owned. Back in our Giro in May, we featured Robin Morton, who had been sports director for the Gianni Motta team at the 1984 Giro. But this is quite a step, because it's the first woman working in that role in the World Tour. And we'll hear from Sherry in, I think, part three of the podcast today. Some other news to wrap up. Quebecca Assos. Are we going with Assos or ASOS? Assos?
Anything's allowed.
Anything's allowed, says Mr. Risotto. we actually had someone on Twitter did take issue. Ben Atkins, I think it was, took issue with Daniel's pronunciation of Assos in last week's podcast. I've always said Assos. The Assos were the premium clothing manufacturer in the 80s, weren't they? And still are, obviously, but they go back a long way. And their chief executive, Derek Bouchard-Hall, got in touch to say that, well, basically say anything goes. Very diplomatic. But I'll stick with Assos, I think.
I'm going to stick with Assos. Daniel, are you going to come over to our way of thinking here, or are you going to stick with ASOS?
I'm usually very relaxed about these things, so you'll probably hear a variety of different pronunciations from me.
I'll tell you what, forward. Daniel, if it's before 11 a.m.
That's not allowed either, is it, that phrase?
If it's before 11 a.m, you're allowed to say ASOS, but after that, it's got
to
be ASOS.
Well, chaps,
do we want
to talk about the actual serious business of the signings, or are we going to do that later?
Well, we're going to get on to that.
Quebec at ASOS have really beefed up their roster. They've been signing riders two or three at a time over, it seems like, every day for the past week. Exaggerate only slightly, but They've added Fabio Aru, the 2015 Vuelta winner, who's had a difficult couple of years. He's had an iliac artery issue that has taken some time to get over. He didn't finish the Tour this year or the Vuelta last year, did he? But he did finish 14th in the Tour de France last year. But Aru is a GC rider and will, well, I mean, when we were talking last week about the riders that were on the market, he was probably the most eye-catching free agent on that list. He's joined by Sergio Henao, former Team Sky and UAE Team Emirates rider, and also former Vuelta stage winner Sander Armey, who was with Lotto Soudal, is going there. But they've added a whole bunch of riders, and I think their roster, if it's not completely
it
full...
It is full now, yeah.
Full now, is it? Right, there we are. Sorry, Daniel,
well, it's been a bit like an advent calendar, hasn't it? They have been announcing a new signing every day. Would you be happy to get a Fabiaro on the 24th of December behind your little window napalm, maybe with a bit of chocolate?
I think it's...
depends how much chocolate.
It depends how much chocolate. I think, as I said last week, it's, you know, they're last in line at the buffet, aren't they? And, you know, Aru, it would be very, very surprising to reach the checkout and leave Aru on the shelf. I mean, presumably it's a deal that works out for both sides. They probably won't be overpaying. Because they probably haven't got the budget to do so. So it's kind of a, could be of mutual benefit to both parties, because Aru needs, well, if he hadn't got a place at Quebec at Assos, then it may not have, well, he wouldn't have been in the World Tour next year, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a risky deal, but it's a deal with fairly significant upside. If you look at, you know, his pedigree, you go back to his 2015 season, he was on the podium in two Grand Tours, won the Vuelta, second in the Giro. So, you know, if he can get back to anything like that level, then obviously it's going to be a masterstroke. But even, you know, even last year, when people talk about Fabio Aru, now it's almost as though he's gone from, you know, boom to complete bust, and he can't even finish races anymore. That's not quite the case. I mean, last year he was actually going pretty well on the other side of lockdown. So ninth at Burgos, he did well in the Mont Ventoux 1 day race, but then had a bit of a meltdown at the Tour de France. Then the UAE, well, he's not the UAE team manager anymore, but he's sort of a consultant. Beppe Saronni went on Italian TV and sort of suggested that Aru was mentally weak and was having a bit of a breakdown, and people sort of seized upon that and took sides, either agreeing with Saronni or very much sympathising with Aru. But my slight worry is his temperament, in the sense that I think he's quite emotive. We saw that at the Tour last year when he pulled out. Obviously, he wasn't in a great place. You know, it hadn't gone well with UAE, with that team, over the previous 2.5 years. And, you know, the camera showed him, you know, getting dropped off the back of the bunch. I mean, anyone's going to be upset in that situation. But he sort of... he became quite angry. We'd seen another incident at the Vuelta a couple of years earlier when he had problems with his bike. And, you know, it's sort of the problem with riders who are saddled with very lofty expectations, having done well early in their career. They themselves fight a battle with sort of the benchmark that they've set earlier, and they get very frustrated. And I guess Aru really needs to overcome that and just find his new sort of dimension, find his level, a level that he's happy at, you know, which might be sort of finishing 10th or 15th in major tours. But even that would be very valuable for his new team, because they've signed a lot of solid rulers, a lot of guys who will be able to get into breakaways, who will be able to work for a leader, but they need a few sort of pieces to build around. We talked about it last week, didn't we? Pozzovivo's one. Simon Clark might be another. Campanarts as well. But and Nizzolo, of course. But they could do with certainly another GC guy, and hopefully Aru will be that for them.
Three last bits of news very quickly. Circus Wanty has a new name. They're stepping up to the World Tour next season after taking over Team CCC's license, and they will be sponsored by a supermarket chain, and so will be known as Intermarché Wanty Gobert. So repeat 50 times. Circus Wanty will be Intermarché Wanty Gobert.
Intermarché is also fine.
Intermarché, okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. The Olympic Games places have been levelled up between men and women for the 2024 Games in Paris. This has been largely achieved by reducing the size of the men's field from 130 riders to 90 riders. And, well, the goal from the UCI has always been to ensure, first of all, medal parity, so that there would be the same number of medals on offer to men and women, and now competitor parity, so the same number of places. But it does mean reducing the field for the men's road events primarily. And finally, UAE Team Emirates are going to vaccinate all their riders and staff against COVID-19 with the Sinopharm vaccine, which has been developed in China and has had trials done in the UAE. It's currently still in one of the final testing phases, I read, but in January, UAE Team Emirates riders and staff will be vaccinated against COVID-19. An interesting one for a sports team to... I haven't seen any other sports teams in any sport say that they would be vaccinating on quite that basis. I think in most places, are the vaccines not kind of in the hands of the health authorities rather than available for people to buy to vaccinate a sports team? I could be wrong on that. Anyone know?
I'm not sure. I was certainly quite surprised. I saw today that they... have announced that Paolo Tiralongo, who joined the team as a sort of mentor to Fabio Aru a few years ago, is leaving. He's no longer going to be a direct sportive. And I must confess, I'm slightly concerned by the name that they've announced as his successor. Bill Gates is going to be in the team car next year.
Oh, goodness me.
Wow.
Oh, my word. Oh, my word. Silly, silly season indeed.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our title sponsor, iWalka. We're very grateful to them for their support. And if you run a small business and want to know what iWalka can do for you, go to iwalka.co.uk. They offer the Sybil's Loans, Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, from £50,001 to £750,000. Borrow for up to 5 years and nothing to pay for 12 months. A Flexi Loan as well. It's a iWalka product from £1,000 to £200,000. And the advantage with iWalka is that you speak to a real person and decisions are made very quickly indeed. So go to iWalka.co.uk if you'd like to find out more about what iWalka can do for your small business. Now, Rod Ellingworth and Mark Cavendish, both in the news this week with their moves. Cavendish to De Koenig Quickstep, back to De Koenig Quickstep. Rod Ellingworth back to Team Ineos. And I guess... maybe that one, the biggest surprise. Ellingworth left Team Ineos last year. He left early after handing in his notice, and relations didn't seem to be very good with Dave Brailsford in particular. He got the opportunity to lead Bahrain McLaren, but there's a bit of uncertainty over that team with McLaren pulling out at the end of the year, and Ellingworth has jumped ship after a year. I've been trying to call him. I know you guys have too. He's not... he's not wanting to talk about it at the moment, but he's back. He's back at Team Ineos, and well, it caught me by surprise. Did it catch you by surprise, Daniel?
It did to a certain extent, Rich. Other Giros, we spoke to Rod and talked to him about, you know, what he was planning next year at Bahrain, and I know he was at the Giro sort of dealing with some issues as regards staffing for next year. He was taking decisions about, you know, people who would and wouldn't be in the team next year. I think he negotiated a contract extension for Peo Bilbao while he was there. And so that was at the Giro, and then at the Vuelta, so only a few days later, again, spoke to him a fair bit about, you know, what he was building for next year and how enthusiastic he was, how enthusiastic some of the riders in the team were about And what they'd seen is a real sort of change of atmosphere in the team over the last few months. And as, you know, he'd come on board and changes had been made. And you know, he was talking about his hope that the team's budget would increase over the next year or two, and that he'd be able to really develop a bit more strength in depth in the team. I think he felt he had good riders there, but didn't have enough really strong riders. So that was about halfway through the Vuelta. No real hint that he was considering his future. And then, well, we got to the end of the Vuelta, and I did notice that he went for lunch with Dave Brailsford on the final day of the Vuelta in Madrid, which I was quite surprised about, because as you say, Rich, we thought that he hadn't left Ineos on particularly great terms, or they'd been taken by surprise by him leaving 2019. So I didn't really know what relations were between Brailsford and Rod at that point. But yeah, they went for lunch together. I was an eyewitness and didn't really think anything more of that. But
what did they
then
have? They're in a
little risotto,
a little tapas bar not far from the finish line. So they were hiding in plain sight. I mean, if it was supposed to be a secret, you know, clandestine meeting of minds, then it wasn't really that, because you could probably, well, yeah, as I say, they were probably visible from the Bahrain team bus. And when the press release was came out. A few days ago, saying that Rod was going to leave the team immediately, I thought that, I started to put two and two together.
Yeah, I suppose I'm fairly surprised. I remember having a conversation with Rod halfway through the tour. We're actually in the Place Raymond Poulidor in Chauvigny. I just remember that because we both commented on the name of the square that the team buses were parked in, and I was asking him how it was going, and he was giving the impression that, you know, he was sort of 7-8 months into what he felt would be a 2-year rebuild to kind of shape the team the way he wanted it, both, you know, on the bike and off the bike. And he said he was enjoying it and hoping, as you say, hoping that there would be the budget to be able to bring in the riders that he would want to bring in over the next couple of winters to make Bahrain McLaren a challenger to the likes of Ineos and Jumbo Visma. And I think he gave me the impression that he was enjoying the fact that he was at the beginning of a particular journey rather than kind of keeping something going, which was what it became at Team Sky and Ineos, you know, just before he left. And now he'll go back, I guess, you know, what will be the difference in his role when he goes back? What is director of racing? You know, how will that differ from race coach, which I think was his previous title? Will he go back into the same sort of job with the same role and responsibilities, or will he have a different part to play? It's he's never really been, you know, the guy in the team car calling the shots a la Nico Portal, has he? He's been a sort of almost a director of football type role rather than a sports director
more
kind of role.
Yeah. Yeah, more on the ground, ahead of the race, really, really detailed in terms of planning and so on. I mean, you know, one thing that occurs to me is that, well, a couple of things have changed. McLaren pulling out was a big thing. They announced that quite some time ago. But, you know, Ellingworth was employed by McLaren. That was the British company as well. And you got the sense a year ago that McLaren were going to be taking more and more of a role over the next few years, and maybe even taking over the team eventually. And at the Tour de France, in the first few days, I spoke to Rod, and he said that they were waiting for news of a new sponsor to come in. And obviously that didn't materialise because Bahrain have stepped up again. And I just wonder if that has, you know, if there are long-term questions about the team's sustainability, you know, beyond next year and the year after. You know, it's maybe not the project that he thought it was a year ago. But also just before, you know, in the year or so before he left Team Ineos, he was promoted to performance director, which was Dave Brailsford's old job title. And there was a sense that Ellingworth was being kind of groomed to take over from Brailsford eventually. We didn't manage to speak to Rod Ellingworth, but I did speak to Dave Brailsford last week, and he did say one thing, and obviously I didn't know at the time about Ellingworth going back there, but he did say one thing about his own future with the team, which with hindsight might be quite interesting.
And it reminded me, thought, what am I doing? You know, it's, I'd like to be involved in a team. I'd like to have a team that when I stop, which will be, I'm not going to carry on forever, you know, so I'm going to be, I'll be stepping away at some point soon. And I'd like to leave a team that's, I'd have loved to have been part of when I left home at 19.
Well, the other aspect to this Rod Ellingworth's departure is that it raises questions of where this leaves the Bahrain team now, because Ellingworth was brought in by the McLaren side of the team to, I guess, be a sort of Dave Brailsford type figure, the leader and talisman, and create an empire, I suppose. You know, that was, if you remember, Rich, when we went down to the McLaren HQ roughly this time last year, that was what they were talking about, wasn't it? It was about building a team over the medium and longer term. And, within a year, Bahrain are going to have to change what they do. And I think we all noticed Brent Copeland, who had been at Bahrain before Rod Ellingworth went in there, tweeting something along the lines of, you know, that wasn't how it was supposed to work out. Copeland is now at the Mitchelton team, of course. And I suppose the other big question about Bahrain is Milan Erzén, who again has denied any involvement or link to the Adalas blood doping ring, which centres on Slovenia. And this has come out again as part of a German investigation into doping centering on Slovenia, blood doping primarily. And so there's lots of different aspects to this that we'll presumably learn a bit more about over the coming month. But certainly Bahrain, the team, is it's going to have to have a Rod Ellingworth replacement. It will need somebody to lead and run the team. We don't really know who that will be at the moment.
The final footnote I'd add to that, Lionel, is that there will be a few individuals there at Bahrain who will have been taken by surprise, I think, by this and won't be thrilled or won't have been thrilled to hear the news. There's obviously quite a distinct British flavour to that team that's come, with Rod, as a result of Rod being recruited a couple of years ago. So there are a few young British riders, Fred Wright, Stephen Williams, Scott Davis. I know, for example, that Rod fought quite hard for Stephen Williams to have his contract renewed. He's had a lot of injury problems the last couple of years, but has been given a new deal. And they're also members of the staff, aren't they? Roger Hammond, one of the direct sportifs, Tim Harris as well. They were sort of brought on board with Rod. And there are other riders, I think, who were just very enthusiastic about working with Rod, the prospect of working with Rod. I spoke to Marco Haller, the Austrian rider, about a year ago when he signed for Bahrain. He said that Rod was one of the main reasons why he wanted to be a part of that team.
Well, the other big story, Mark Cavendish, Ellingworth's former protege. And, you know, it's funny, there was an interview with Patrick Lefebvre on Cycling News, very revealing, an interesting interview, where he gives a bit more detail about how this move came about. But it happened just a day or so after Dipana, which was the final classic of the year. I was there, and I spoke to Yves Lampaert about the prospect of Cavendish joining Deceuninck Quick. So he was very enthusiastic, you know, a big fan, a big admirer of Cavendish. And I spoke to Cavendish as well at the end of the race. He'd fallen off, he'd been in the front echelon and crashed. And he said he was very tight-lipped, as they say, about his future, but made it pretty clear that he wanted to stay in the sport. I spoke to Tristan Hoffman as well, who his director at Bahrain McLaren, who said how keen he was to stay in the sport. And it was, well, we know now from the Patrick Lefebvre interview that the meeting with Lefebvre happened a day or so later. And it seemed to be conditional on Cavendish bringing in a sponsor. And this is an interesting dimension to the story. We had an agent last week, of course, Gary McQuaid, talking about this being a thing of the past, that riders, you know, are no longer expected to bring sponsors in. Cavendish is maybe a slightly different case, but it was a claim that really jumped out of the piece at me. I don't know what you guys thought.
Well, yes, Rich, and I suppose we need further clarification. I've been trying to get a hold of Mark's agent today just to get some clarification on that, because it's a little bit of a grey area. I mean, Normally, all sponsors are getting involved with professional cycling teams to be associated with certain athletes, whether it's a whole group of athletes, which is, you know, usually the case, or in some cases, without declaring it, that might be the main motivation for certain sponsors to align themselves with a team. In this case, we don't know whether it's a private individual that Patrick Lefebvre is talking about, whether it's an existing sponsor. I mean, for example, you know, I know that Mark had an association with and a sort of a friendship, a relationship with Specialized Bikes that went beyond his time with the previous incarnation of this team. So, you know, he remained very good friends, I think, with Mike Signard, who is the founder of Specialized. And you know, it may be that Specialized have just decided to pony up a bit more cash in order to have Mark in the team. So we need a bit more clarification. But, you know, a lot of people have pointed out that this is a practice that's previously been sort of condemned and even punished. In 2017, there was an investigation in Italy, and this was led by the Italian Cycling Federation, and it resulted in our good friend Gianni Savio being sentenced to a 3-month ban on appeal, because essentially there was a rider who joined his team, Androni Giocattoli, and it was determined that he was a rider who wouldn't have got a spot on the team, but he had agreed to bring on board two sponsors. I can't remember exactly which sponsors they were. And the same also happened.
Androni and Giocattoli.
Yes. And the same.
Come on, Daniel. Also, there's only 22 of them to narrow it down.
Yeah, I hope it wasn't Guava Berry Golf. That would that would shatter my some of my romantic and visions of how that deal came about. But and Angelo Citracca of the, well, now the team is called Vini Zabu, he was also given a 3-month sentence. I mean, they were effectively banned from races for 3 months for something very similar. And indeed, actually, there was a third team, so third pro Conti team at the time, what is now Bardiani, their manager as well, Bruno Reverberi, was also sentenced. But that was an Italian Cycling Federation court that made those decisions in that instance, although at the time they did say that they were going to pass the documentation, pass the information on to the UCI, but there was no further action taken against the three teams I mentioned there.
I guess there are two aspects to this. I mean, I don't know if Lefebvre has, you know, not, he's not really done Cavendish a favour there, because the suggestion is that Cavendish is there because he was able to bring in extra money rather than because of his abilities as a rider. I'm not sure that really matters to a rider of Cavendish's kind of stature, but looking beyond that at the kind of the narrative arc of Cavendish's career, he has had three or four pretty awful seasons of steady decline. And you know, when I think of him standing in that car park in Depana, you know, miserable day, blowing a hoolie, chucking it down with rain, and he was feeling sorry for himself having crashed, that would not have been a fitting way for him to end his career. And at least going back to the kind of quick set for one last hurrah, you know, even if he doesn't contest another sprint finish, even if he's just part of the team, it does give him the opportunity to go out in a more appropriate way than in a car park in Depana in early November.
Yeah, I think there's, I was going to say, you know, famously somebody, didn't they once say there's no gifts in professional cycling? That was Lance Armstrong after he gifted Marco Pantani a win on Mont Ventoux, of course, in the Tour de France. But, you know,
it was originally Bernardino, though, wasn't it? Paddy Cadeau. Did he not tell Armstrong that, in fact?
That does ring a bell, yeah. You know, whether or not, you know, Mark Cavendish is one of the greatest riders of all time. You know, in terms of the Tour de France stages he's won, World Championship he's won, the Milan-San Remo he's won, and whilst there's no room in a sort of cutthroat professional sport, there's no room for sentimentality, I'd agree that, you know, Cavendish does deserve a more fitting send-off than a coronavirus interrupted season, you know, no kind of last hurrah in, you know, the Tour de France. There still may not be, of course, in the Tour de France, but the opportunity to race for one more season, and you know, perhaps he can hit a patch of form and get himself over the finish line ahead of everybody else somewhere, whether it's a big win or a small win. You know, I think there is a more fitting denouement to Cavendish's season than, as you say, Rich, just kind of climbing off his bike at the end of 3 days of Depana in miserable conditions.
I think what this also gives him the opportunity to do is to be part of a winning team. You know, I think it might no longer be about him. I think we've seen in the past, Cavendish has been very willing to be a teammate and to do his bit for the team. And if he can be part of that winning machine and involved in wins, I've seen some quotes from Wilfred Peters today saying that in a lot of the races in the early season, they want him to be basically finish at 5Ks to go, you know, do his job for the team and then, you know, contribute what he can rather than be the guy that they're working for. I think that's probably a more likely scenario, especially in a team like that. But I think he will derive a lot of satisfaction from that. If he can be involved in wins, I think, again, that would also be a kind of more fitting way for him to exit.
Yeah, I think the other thing we should point out is that the key distinction between this instance, even if it did come to light that you know, a sponsor had agreed to pony up some extra money to sort of guarantee his salary. And the key difference between this and those other cases I mentioned earlier of the Italian teams is that those riders in those instances were effectively only bringing the sponsor, and it was sort of decided that there was no other sort of meritocratic reason for them to be on those particular teams. Whereas in this case, what De Koninck and Quickstep are paying for is a body of work which guarantees a certain amount of, well, of publicity and prestige, and they're, you know, they're associating themselves with that as well as what Cavendish can bring on top as a rider. As far as how much he can contribute is concerned, I mean, the great mystery really is how good an athlete he is now, and this is what we can't really say with any confidence. We don't really know. I remember speaking to Rod Ellingworth in the summer, actually, at the Dauphiné, so just after lockdown, about, you know, whether Mark might still make it to the Tour, into the Tour team for Bahrain, or how he was actually going. And Rod said that the lockdown had been sort of fatal for his chances of riding the Tour. And he'd actually been going pretty well in the spring last year. He'd worked quite well with Phil Bauhaus, the German sprinter, a couple of early season races. But the lockdown had really killed his momentum. And I think, you know, Rich, you've mentioned this as well, that quite a lot of the teams in their sort of final analysis of the very unusual 2020 season said that it was the older riders that suffered, and they suffered in particular with things like weight control, and a lot of them came out of the other end. I mean, we saw it with guys like Valverde, they weren't quite themselves, whereas, you know, we all talked about this great wave of new young talent. And, you know, that is no doubt a real thing, that is no doubt happening, but it might also be due to the very unusual season that we had in 2020. So, you know, judging the second half of Cavendish's season is quite difficult, and you probably have to layer in a few caveats. But, you know, we haven't analysed the power files, you know, we don't know whether realistically he can still measure up to the guys who will be contesting sprints in 2021. The very worst case scenario is that this can be a dignified, worthy victory tour, victory lap at the end of, as we say, a fantastic career.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That said, PK, to remind us to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by LACA. LACA is a community of cyclists working together to insure bikes and equipment in the event of damage or loss. By forming a collective, they ensure that the premiums are lower and the payouts in the event of a claim are swifter. Because Laka are well known to us and have a lot of our listeners as customers, they have formed a community of cycling podcast listeners within their wider community. Visit laka.co and use the code TCP when you sign up to join our community within Laka. By doing so, you will be supporting the cycling podcast. I'm a Laka customer, but thankfully I haven't had to make a claim yet. Let's hear from somebody who has.
Hi, my name's Leslie. I've been a Laka customer since summer of last year. So went out for a bike ride with my mate Tom. We'd signed up to an ultra endurance race and we decided to start our training a little bit early in the October. And about 10k into the ride, I took a bit of a hard crash on the pavement, and the front end of the bike took the main brunt of it. I ruptured my EPL, which basically means that you can't hitchhike, and the thumb doesn't move, doesn't really do anything. They've got a live chat on their app and on their website where you can immediately talk to someone and ask them a question. One of the members of staff there immediately, you know, responded to me. They were the ones that had actually said, oh, it looks like you've got a crack on your bike. If I were dealing with another insurance company, they probably, you know, they wouldn't even have picked that up. They are riders. They know what they're talking about. You know, they come from a cycling history. And literally within 24 hours, the amount of money that I had claimed for, it was, 24 hours and the money was transferred into my account.
Well, the big news for Laka is that they are launching soon in the Netherlands. So if any Dutch listeners would like to know more, go to laka.co/NL. As I said earlier, new customers can get £10 off when they sign up with Laka. Go to laka.co, that's laka.co, and use the code TCP to join the cycling podcast community. Well, last week, at the end of last week, we had what we thought was the Team Sunweb launch presentation for 2021. And I think everybody was surprised to discover that it was actually a rebranding, a new sponsor, DSM, huge company from the Netherlands, as you mentioned earlier, Lionel, taking over from Sunweb, a holiday company. And I guess, you know, the holiday industry is not faring well under coronavirus, so in that sense not a surprise. But Sunweb were a long-term sponsor with a kind of a rolling agreement, and so really DSM appear to have come in to save the team, reading between the lines. And I guess the great achievement of the team has been to manage that transition without anybody really knowing that there was uncertainty over the team. And the man who deserves credit for that is Ivan Spekenbrink, the boss at that team. He's been in charge since the start, hasn't he? All the way back to the Skill Shimano days, I think, when they were a pro-continental team beginning to emerge and become a World Tour team. I spoke to Spekenbrink about this new sponsor and also their veteran rider, Nicholas Roach, about being part of this team. He's been big teams before, obviously BMC and Team Sky, and how Sunweb, now DSM, matches up. Let's hear first from Spekenbrink and then from Roach.
I mean, this is an absolute major, major company, and one of the biggest companies out there. I'm not sure if you've seen the show. It's huge, so this is not something that you do overnight. They have procedures in place, they have stakeholders, they have a board, they have executive board, they have supervisory board. I mean, this is, with these kind of companies and also with this kind of deals, it's not something that you do overnight. And of course, we're already working a long time with this company, and it was definitely a dream of also of me personally that one day we could do this with this company, because its relevance for the team, it's bringing innovations to a complete new level into the sport, but also being relevant in terms of social responsibility. I mean, what they do is also a lot outside the world of sports, in which we contribute their efforts. Yeah, that's obviously a dream. It's so big. So you don't do it overnight. And it just became, like I said in the presentation, so much changes here with COVID that what was a dream, became now something like, well, let's now really go for this dream and let's make it happen. There were more scenarios on the table. Obviously, we Sunweb is very happy with us, and we can only be grateful for how they have supported us, and also not only being a partner of the team, but being a true partner, that we could the way how we believe that you can best perform within our frame of values, how to get the best out of ourselves. They just supported this. So we are grateful to them. And then, of course, if COVID strikes and you have all these restrictions, measures, etc., yeah, it was one option to continue like that. But for them, marketing is a little bit less relevant if you cannot sell so much. Obviously they support the team, but when there was a unique opportunity and when that moment came, we went back to Sunweb, obviously, and say we can make our dream come true. And that was done all in good harmony.
The season that you've had can't have done any harm in selling the team to DSM. I mean, did that help to clinch it? It was, we noticed you didn't seem to be around all that much at the Tour de France, and maybe that becomes clearer now. Were you sort of in meetings? Were you trying to tie this up? How helpful was the performance at the Tour in terms of just sealing the deal?
There is. I mean, we are in a sports world, and one of the things you're measured of is performance. So, if they say you are a nice team, nice people, but the performance is poor, does obviously not help. I mean, that's an important factor. But this story, obviously, that we spoke with, that we exchanged ideas with DSM, that we build on concepts, and then you have the legal issue, you have the stakeholders issue. So obviously we were already far advanced, but it's always nice that people get a confirmation of what we do. So it's never bad, even though the process was already on its way, of course.
Did the riders have any inkling that this work was going on behind the scenes to secure the team's future?
No. We just, like I said, it was, for me personally, it was a bit almost schizophrenic at some times. I definitely wanted to. I saw this year as an opportunity. We are not the people who say, the world is different. You have to keep 1.5 meter distance. When will there be races? Which races? People, you can panic, and we always believe in opportunity. It means also, we can make quicker improvements than others. So we focus day and night on making riders better, actually improving the people in our organization, making coaches literally better, experts better, create more knowledge. And that paid off. And at the same time, it was sometimes in the nights, the other part, it was like putting this in place. So it was very intense. But no, we kept the calm, and we kept just focusing on not we need now results, but on getting better. And then you get quicker results.
First of all, big kudos to Sunweb for holding strong till the end of the year. And, you know, we're one of the teams that did not suffer from any staff or rider being fired or staff restrictions or salary cuts or whatever. So big thank you for them for supporting us all the way through this year. And obviously a massive thank you to DSM for taking over for the next few years. Just as you mentioned, it's been quite a financial hit for almost every business on the planet this year. And it's very difficult to find someone with, you know, that kind of budget to come into a cycling business. So it's, you know, it's quite remarkable. And when you look at the resources that they can actually bring to the team, it's pretty exciting and pretty amazing. I think it's probably a first to have a title sponsor that can actually bring multiple assets to the team in terms of technology, in terms of diet, provide their own supplements, but also the technology into cycling wear as well with the Dyneema project. So I think it's quite interesting, and I'm really looking forward to working even closer with them.
I was going to ask you as well, Nicholas, how are you enjoying being part of this team? You've been on big teams before. Sunweb, though, you know, there seemed to be something special about that team this year in particular, and at the Tour de France especially, the way that you rode it as a team had often multiple options on stages and got some rewards, some great rewards as well. How are you enjoying being part of the team, and how did you enjoy in particular the Tour de France?
I really enjoy being part of the team. It's you know, the first couple of months was, you know, like I said, like you said, it's a team that is very, very different in how they work, and it took me some time to adapt. But now that I've completely adapted, I think last year was I was really settled in and felt that I was in the right team, and my role was quite well established in terms of what was expected from me and what I could deliver on the bike for the team. And then coming into the tour, well, you know, my role on the bike was to really, really support the guys, guide them, put them into the best position for them to deliver. And wow, they delivered. And, you know, we were quite similar type of riders. We didn't have, you know, someone that could win the mountaintop finish, for example. We focused on some stages. The plan was very, very clear. Management had days where we were completely off. The goal was like, all right, today is everyone's in the gruppetto. We lose as much time as we want. And tomorrow it's on the attack again. And every day there was a clear plan. The thing with these teams is they work on protocols. And when you get second, third, fifth, and seventh, you're told that your protocols are not good. But when you keep that protocol and then eventually you start getting wins, then suddenly you're coming from the wrong someone who thinks you're using wrong protocols or racing wrong to being a mastermind or a genius. Mm. So the borderline is very, very subtle there. And, you know, at the end of the day, what was really, really remarkable in the tour was not only the tactic, but the fact that it was all about trying to win, but not to win as an individual, but trying to win for the team. And we saw it. There was days we had 10 guys up the front and there was three of us. And it was all about, not about saving the legs and seeing, all right, can I get third, maybe try and win a stage of the Tour de France. And we're talking the tourist stage of the Tour de France. I've done 10 of them dreaming of a stage win. And this year round, I was sacrificing myself for the young lads because I knew they could get it, where I've tried it already and I've been always close enough. And them getting it, that was, you know, for me, it was, obviously, it's incomparable. I did not win at stage or Tour de France, but I had some kind of satisfaction in saying, all right, I'm doing my job right, and these guys are delivering.
You're obviously with the team next year. I want to use the word experience. You're very experienced now. Do you think about, you know, your role has obviously changed, but do you think about how much longer you want to be a professional for?
I'm not ready to stop. I'm not ready to stop. I love my work too much. I have too much passion. I still feel I can bring something to the sport. I don't feel useless. You know, some riders, it could be in terms of results. I know in terms of results, I can still get results, but I know I'm useful for this new generation of riders and I can really bring something to them. I'm still a strong personality in the world of cycling, and I just love my job. I'm not ready to stop. How long? Unfortunately, I think I will not be the one that will decide it, but hopefully at least another, so 21 plus 2, that would be, I would love to go until 23.
Well, Speck and Brink, they're chaps, you know, not giving too much away about the conversations he's been having, the meetings he's been involved in this year. And I thought it was very interesting, Roach saying that the team, the riders were sort of oblivious if there was uncertainty. They never had any salary cuts or, you know, there wasn't talk of the team not surviving. And the environment they seemed to have created, one where, you know, the emphasis, the priority, the focus was on performance, obviously worked well for them because they had a terrific season from, you know, Tour de France to the Giro, two men on the podium at the Giro. And I guess, you know, great credit to Speck and Brink for managing this process apparently seamlessly.
Well, I think, Rich, it is certainly very praiseworthy what they've managed to do there. And the origins of, well, this new sponsorship deal are to be found. If you go back a couple of years and look at the last time that Sunweb renewed their contract or was the last time there was an announcement about the team sponsorship. In 2018, there was a new deal with Sunweb announced, and what was reported then was that the company would sponsor the team at least until the end of 2019, and when the existing contract expired, a new one with no set date would be activated. And also that even if the team and Sunweb decided to terminate the deal at any point, the sponsorship would still run for another 2 years, plus the remainder of the year in which the release clause was triggered. So we don't know exactly when Sunweb communicated to Speckenbrink that they were going to pull out, but the team was never in any immediate danger, and I guess this also explains why the Sunweb logo will still appear on the jersey next year, because they will still be funding the team to some extent.
Well, as we've said a lot over the racing season since the lockdown eased and racing returned, you know, Sunweb really had performed better than expected, really. I mean, certainly the Tour de France, so they when you looked at the roster at the start of the tour and the kind of the absence of a GC rider there, you wondered a little bit, what are they going to do in the race? Of course, we knew Mark Hirschi was a talent, but we didn't quite anticipate him, getting off the front with Adam Yates and Julian Alaphilippe over the hills in Nice and being one of the men of the day right at the start of the tour, and then getting his... Well, he came very close, and then he finally got his stage win. And of course, Hirschi has been one of the stories of the season with his performances elsewhere. Really interesting to see how he continues that on next season. I mean, you know, the performance in Flèche Wallonne and the World Championships and so on, real A-list stuff. But what will be interesting for me is to see how Romain Bardet settles into that team. They've lost Wilco Kelderman. They've still got Jai Hindley, another big breakthrough performance at the Giro, of course, finishing on the podium, nearly winning the thing. But Romain Bardet, an established rider with some kind of frailties, vulnerability to his game, I guess, going from a position where, you know, he was the outstanding team leader of AG2R. Everything was kind of for him at the Tour de France for a number of years, and perhaps if you remember François Thomazeau making the point this time last year that Bardet needed to perhaps broaden horizons and target something different, and the plan had been for him to ride the Giro d'Italia this season if the season had gone ahead as normal. But it'll be interesting to see how he slots into this team, which has kind of made us speciality of being competitive across the board, hasn't it? It's not really got a one focal point, and I wonder whether that will change with the emergence of Hirschi, particularly for, you know, well, he did say in the press thing that he did this week, which I did record, Rich, but the quality is not great to play back. But he did say that for the time being, he's not going to be transitioning to a sort of Grand Tour type rider. He's going to focus on one day races and stage wins and that kind of thing. He's not really in a hurry doesn't really need to hurry to do anything. He's still only 22, but it will be interesting to see, you know, how he responds now that everyone knows who he is and what he's capable of. But yeah, certainly a team to watch. And I think, Rich, you've made the case that pound for pound, probably the team of the year.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
A question for James Morton at Science Support from James Lilly. I've been reading about the benefits of beetroot in regards to exercise. Does James have any thoughts regarding this, and or do any of their products, Science and Sports products, emulate this, contain beetroot? That's from James Lilly.
Yes, thanks for your question, James. You're absolutely right. In the last 10 to 15 years, there's been an explosion of research all investigating the effects of nitrate on performance. And the reason why it's referred to as beetroot is because beetroot actually contains nitrate. So a lot of the studies have used beetroot juice as the substance to deliver the nitrate. And effectively what we see in all of those studies, it improves what's called our efficiency. And what that means is that we actually require less oxygen to perform at the same workload. And then as a result, the exercise is easier and power output can improve and we go faster for longer and so on. And this has been observed in not just cycling, also in running type studies, also in team sport type exercise as well. Now, from a practical point of view, the big problem is a lot of athletes just don't like the taste of beetroot. And actually, we've been working hard at Science and Sport in the last few years to try and overcome this. And just a few months ago, we launched the nitrate range, which isn't based on using beetroot as the nitrate source. Rather, we've used rhubarb and spinach extract. And so we've got a whole host of products in this space, which are nitrate rich, but use different sources of nitrate. And the taste profile is completely different. So if you haven't tried that and you are interested in nitrate as an ergogenic aid, if you like, then I would definitely recommend that you try these products and hopefully they do make a difference to you.
Well, that was James Morton, the Director of Performance Solutions at Science and Sport, also Professor of Exercise Metabolism and Nutrition at Liverpool John Moores University. And, he has been answering your questions thanks to our sponsorship with Science and Sport. They have supported us since 2016. If you have a question for James, please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Any nutrition questions at all about your own sports nutrition or the pros nutrition, email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com. And enter the code SISCP25.
How do I fuel for a 12-hour relay on the turbo, Richard? That's the big question. We've got one coming up.
Well, you'll have to email contact@thecyclingpodcast.com and we'll put your question, Lionel, to James Morton.
Excellent.
How about that?
Thank you.
Can't say fairer than that.
Great.
We do have a 12-hour event coming up, Cranked Up, we're going to take part in, aren't we, as a relay. Look up Cranked Up. You'll find it on the internet, raising money for some good causes. Now, Lionel, we should mention at this point as well, before we hear Sherry Pridham and about her move to Israel's Startup Nation, friends of the podcast, people have been signing up again as a friend of the podcast. Our new system launched just over a year ago, so people are signing up once again for 2021. There's a new friend special coming up this week. It's part one of a two-parter, which you mentioned, you teased earlier. Part two will follow a week or so later. It's been really good fun to work on this one. But thanks everyone who has signed up as a friend of the podcast. You can do so at thecyclingpodcast.com. For £15, that will gain you access to all of the friend specials that we release. And we've got more coming over Christmas as well. And for £50, you will get an exclusive gift. Your choice of either a Cycling Podcast casquette or a brand new, very beautiful tea towel. If you sign up as a friend for £100, well, first of all, thank you very much for your support. It's essential to us and we are very appreciative. And you'll get both gifts. You'll get the tea towel and the casquette, and it's a very, you've just taken delivery of the casquettes, Lionel.
I have.
What do they look like?
Oh, they're fantastic. They're very...
Why aren't you wearing one?
Good question. Well, the reason I'm not wearing one is the big box of caps has arrived. It's on my dining table, and my daughter has got one, and now she calls that my hat. My hat.
Well, I'm glad that's the reason. I thought you were going to say it's because they're all extra small or something.
No, they're not. They're lovely. They've been made by Miltag for us. And, you can see a design if you sign up to our newsletter. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com. I can, yes. It's got a sort of dusky pink peak with the Cycling Podcast logo on it. It's got a pale blue and white kind of almost jigsaw design on the sides with the sound wave motif, which also features on our Katusha jersey, and a very attractive dark blue strip down the center. So traditional cycling cap style, very nice material, and it says Friend of the Cycling Podcast on the side. We'll be posting these out in the new year once the tea towels have arrived as well.
Are you gonna post one to us maybe at some point?
I will do, yeah.
Can I get one?
Yeah.
Do I have to sign up as a friend to get one?
No, you can have one, I guess. Yeah, you
Thanks.
Can have one. Daniel's a
You've
big
got my
fan,
address, I believe.
A big fan of the casquette, so I'll get one out to Daniel. I'll just put Daniel Freeb. International Man of Mystery, and it will find you somehow. Wherever you are, Daniel, it will reach you. But just on the Friends of the Podcast system, if you signed up last year, there is an auto-renew option, which is default. So if you haven't disabled that, you don't need to do anything. Your subscription will just continue seamlessly. And yeah, thank you very much for your support, because it does enable us to plan 2021 and our coverage of the three Grand Tours. I've also got a quite an exciting Explore project that I'm that I'm planning at the moment that has really captured my imagination. Looking forward to hopefully doing that in early June. More on that at some point in the future.
And keep your feedback coming as well. We always enjoy getting your feedback. Really enjoyed this tweet from Bob Oliver. probably in response to last week's episode, probably the most boring podcast ever, this one. Went on far too long, interviews interminable. Was your editor on holiday? Not your finest, guys. End of season lethargy, methinks. Probably a good idea on paper, but execution poor. We're kind of flattered that you'd think we'd commit these ideas to paper. Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you, Bob, for that. Well, we should probably get on with the next interminable interview. No. Cherie Pridham, I mean, she's been in the news in the last week. She has been appointed sports director for Israel's Startup Nation World Tour team, of course, and really stepping up next year with Chris Froome joining, Sepp van Marke joining, Mike Woods and others. So a huge opportunity for her, and a very newsworthy story, because she is the first female sports director in the World Tour. We featured Robin Morton, who was a DS at the 1984 Giro, as you said, Lionel, in our Giro, and also in a previous episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina. But I spoke to Cherie Pridham this week just to find out how this move had come about.
It goes back to sort of April time, just before we went, well, while we were in lockdown. And as you do, you know, I sort of started looking at how it improved, which was Vitus Pro Cycling at the time. And we knew we were going to be, we were headhunting sponsors anyway to continue. And then long story short, we had quite a warm lead, which fell through because of COVID and the kind of uncertainty of return on investment for this particular sponsor. And the uncertainty of the race program and delivery and here with the domestic scene. So I thought, okay, you know, we can drag this through, we can take it through. And then, you know, I don't know, it was sort of September time. I thought, right, there's no way I can risk registering the team UCI. I'm going to take the team through at elite level. And then as it happened, we lost another small sponsor for similar reasons. And then I started questioning my own kind of ability to survive as a, you know, as just general paying the bills and looking after myself, so to speak, because it was quite clear that I'd have to start looking for a proper job to support my income and also try and take a team through at elite level. And that wasn't, it just wasn't looking great at all. I think I applied for 30, 40 jobs in the real world, and I think I had three responses, and I thought, well, why not put my name out there with some World Tour teams? So I did, you know, I reached out to a handful, and I had a response almost straight away from Israel Startup Nation, initially with a phone call. Was very excited about the fact that Kjell Kahlström took time out of his busy schedule to even pick the phone up and chat to me and listen to my aims and my ambitions and, you know, what I wanted to achieve as a person, but what potentially I could bring to his team. And then, of course, they were so busy with the Vuelta and, well, the Giro and then the Vuelta, never really heard anything. But in the meantime, you know, things were sort of going in the wrong direction for my own team. We had a board meeting. Long story short, I came away from that board meeting knowing that I needed to make the decision, and it wasn't a good one, and that was to close the team. But, you know, on my terms, I was very determined not to fail if I'd taken the team through at elite level and then maybe lost another sponsor in April, or, you know, and I just thought, you know, while I can I don't suppose finishing at the top sounds the right sort of phrase, but I wanted it under my terms. And we made the decision at board level. I came back and spoke to my family. And then within an hour, I had a contract offer of closing one team down. And the two just wouldn't have been, you know, I just couldn't have imagined having a contract offer literally an hour after I closed one team down.
Wow.
An emotional day for sure.
I mean, you know, you touch on your job in the last several years has been, you know, not just being a DS, but running a team and, you know, managing a business, I suppose. It must be nice to have a job now and look forward to a job where you will just be able to focus on the sporting side, I guess.
Oh, 100%. I'm so, so excited. I mean, I had a little bit of a taster when I was employed by Rally, and, you know, we had, you know, a very, very decent budget in those days. And then I was employed and I was able to do what, what I'm sort of good at. But just the enormity and the size of this team has made me realize just how big this opportunity is. And the fact that there are that many people that are there to help, not just me as a DS, but all the DSs on ISN, make our job, you know, that much more easier, because we've got performance coaches and everything else that work towards one goal, if you like.
And if you look at the riders you'll be working with, you know, obviously Chris Froome, but yeah, Mike Woods, Sepp van Marck, Dan Martin, you know, some of the best riders in the world. How much do you relish that prospect?
I can't wait. Of course I'm going to have a little bit of, you know, sort of apprehension and so on. But I just generally treat everybody, you know, I think what people don't really realise with me is what you see with me is what you get. And I'm pretty relaxed. I'm fairly calm in majority of decisions I make. And, you know, I think I've had that success, and managing people and riders different sort of personalities is one of my skills. And a bike rider is a bike rider at the end of the day.
There's been a lot of focus, obviously, on the fact you're the first female sports director in a men's world tour team, I should say. Is that important to you? Is that something that makes you feel particularly proud, or is it kind of irrelevant? I've seen some comments from you saying that, you know, your job is just sports director, not female sports director.
Well, first and foremost, yeah, that's how I've seen myself right back in as far as the early days when I took over Rally, and, you know, I was the first female to head a UCI British Conti team. And it's exactly the same here, but I've never seen myself as I'm different to everybody else. I've just been one of the boys, if you like, and I want that to continue. Really, I know from the significance of all the, you know, the press interest and everything, I might need to change and look, because I've had so many messages of. With women particularly coming to me saying thank you for showing us the way, you know, you've given us so much confidence and real lovely messages. And I think, you know, I might need to look at that and pay a little bit more attention to that role that I've sort of acquired, I guess, in the last 3 years.
Maybe in the reactions of some others you can maybe get a truer sense of a kind of wider significance to it.
I think it needs to sink in as well, you know. It clearly is bigger than I ever imagined.
Well, it does feel like a significant move, doesn't it? But perhaps it shouldn't really, because I think, you know, I was thinking about this in light of the announcement and was pondering, you know, when Marianne Vos retires or Lizzie Deignan retires or Anna van der Breggen retires, are we really to think that they wouldn't be capable and experienced enough to do the job of sports director for a men's team? I think that anyone who's raced at the highest level, and certainly anyone who's done the job in the Women's World Tour would be, you know, the sort of person that could apply for and be given a job in the Men's World Tour. And Sherry Pridham has been doing this job in men's cycling, numerous tours to Yorkshire and tours of Britain, which are, okay, not World Tour events, but you're dealing with all of the same challenges and difficulties and tactical decisions that need to be made as she will face in the World Tour. And I did see a comment on our Facebook discussion group, Rich. Somebody made the point that, and I don't know whether this stacks up, but it's something that was really interesting to me, that in rowing, often the cox is, or, you know, not often, but the cox can be a woman as well as a man, and, you know, no one bats an eyelid. And I wonder whether there's some similarity between the type of role in the team car. Is the sports director a bit like the cox in rowing? And so I don't think there should be.
I guess in rowing, physical size is a factor there, isn't it? Because you're carrying them. They're not carrying their sports directors on their bikes yet. In a little sidecar, that would be
that is true. So you mean they're chosen? The fact that they're lighter weight means that
coxes are always very small, aren't they? Little Colin Moynihan, remember him, the old sports minister? He was a cox, wasn't he?
Yeah. Okay. But then, you know, when that becomes important, then suddenly there's no barrier to having a woman who is the same weight as a light man.
Well, it's obviously not the only thing. No, exactly. It's obviously not the only thing.
That just interested me, and it just made me think that I think that the first appointee is, you know, could open the door and allow others. You know, once somebody has appointed a woman to do that job, in a way, you know, while it shouldn't make it easier, I think it probably will make it easier for other teams to follow suit. And as I say, as you know, as the Women's World Tour also matures and expands and grows in terms of, you know, how many events there are and the types of races there are and so on, more people from the Women's World Tour may well be able to cross over into the Men's World Tour and vice versa.
I think you raised an interesting point, Lionel, there about how applicable, well, you know, different skill sets are. If someone's had a history in British racing as opposed to the Women's World Tour, as opposed to the Men's World Tour, I mean, it could, one point of view is that it might be an advantage not to be as experienced. I know this isn't the case here. Sherry's worked in men's cycling for a long time, but, you know, someone who's solely worked on the Women's World Tour might have a lot to bring to Men's World Tour racing, simply because they're not conditioned and hardwired by the same sort of dogmas that we see playing out day after day, race after race, that, you know, you can't let a break go in these circumstances or those circumstances. I mean, Rich, are there many, I'm trying to think of examples, I can think of men, male direct sportifs that have worked in the Women's World Tour, but I'm trying to think of someone who's gone back then. And what do you think of that? There are certain principles, certainly there's a lot, there's a lot more aggressive racing in Women's World Tour, and sometimes you kind of wonder whether that could be, that should be applied to men's cycling a bit more.
I mean, predominantly there are male sports directors in the Women's World Tour. There are fewer female sports directors, but one team that did come in, you know, when they launched their women's team, Trek Segafredo, did so with two female sports directors, and they've had an outstanding season. They've been the team of the year, really. They really hit their stride this year. So, you know, Anna van der Breggen, you mentioned, Lionel, she will retire at the end of next year to become a sports director with her team. And that's good to see more female sports directors in women's cycling too. And the journey's been done the other way. Rolf Aldag, who's been at, you know, men's teams over the years, went this year to Canyon-SRAM. So there's no reason why there couldn't be a two-way exchange. But I think, you know, not to say that men can't be sports directors in the Women's World Tour, but it's good to see female sports directors in Women's World Tour teams doing well. And that's certainly increasingly the case, I think. I mean, we should mention, I mean, there are others like Rachel Heal, you know, who's was a sports director for many years for United Healthcare. Perhaps still is. Is she? I can't. I've lost. Actually, I should check on that. I think she still is. Well, there are others. I mean, Rachel Heal, a sports director at United Healthcare, has DS'd for the women's and men's teams over the years. We did feature her in that episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina a couple of years ago as well.
Well, by coincidence, Richard, Simon Barnes, who owned and ran the Plowman Craven Madison team just over a decade ago, was the person who hired Sherry Pridham to be the sports director for the team. And he runs the Cycling Cafe, the hub here in Not Watford, or to give it its proper name, Redbourne, and also owns a bike shop in the village. No longer owns the Plowman Craven team. Well, the Plowman Craven team doesn't exist anymore, but he ran that team for a number of years, and they rode the Tour of Britain several times. And I spoke to him about Sherry Pridham, and also to James Millard, who both rode for the Plowman Craven team when Sherry Pridham was the sports director, and also worked alongside her in the team car as assistant sports director to Pridham at Team Rally.
She's very good. She's very focused. She's very experienced of what she did, and she has, which probably not a lot of people know, she was a very, very successful rider on her own account in Europe. She came from South Africa, and the only thing she wanted to do was to ride professionally as a female cyclist. And she came over to the UK from South Africa with, I don't know this literally, but with £5 in her pocket. Her house is full of awards from the Tour de Féminin and King of the Mountains and various events in the Alps and the Pyrenees. Well, I can remember the first conversation we had was the Blackpool, used to be the Blackpool Grand Prix on the Sunday and Crits on the Promenade on the Saturday. And I can remember talking to her about at the Crits. It was cold. There were very few spectators, and we were just sitting talking and said, well, you know, perhaps next year, let's talk about it seriously. So I'd always had respect for her. She brought a lot of young riders on, a lot of the riders that she'd taken on as young people, it ended up moving up the ladder. I don't know, several years, just when you're talking in the pits and what have you. But I wasn't looking for a sports director at the time. But she showed a lot of interest, and I said, yeah, well, let's do it. Gender didn't come into it, really, to be honest. And no, I didn't have any qualms at all. I didn't even think about, that's a woman rather than a man. It didn't go through my mind, to be honest. It was more the success that she'd had. Yeah, well, she was very, people knew where they were with her. She was very, very firm, very clear, unambiguous. This is what's going to happen, guys. She was very decisive, and I don't ever remember shouting at all. But I remember a lot talking in a very firm way, taking people to one side, saying, this is how it is, this is what it's going to be. It's not up for discussion. And it was very effective.
I think that something that obviously struck us, it was the first time for a lot of us that we had been managed by a woman. And I think the key point that we took home from it, that there was actually no difference whatsoever, as you would expect in a way. She was extremely professional, and everything ran exactly as it would do in any other scenario. No barriers at all. I think at the end of the day, it's just purely about how you communicate with the riders that you're managing. If you can do that, then sex is irrelevant. She was, she's very good. Obviously, you don't survive in this game for as long as she has without being able to. She's able to relate both on a riding level and as a director from her own expansive career around Europe in a time where it was obviously very difficult to be a professional female cyclist. She's got a lot of extra insights into a world that that maybe we didn't have to live through ourselves.
Well, just returning to Rachel Heal, who I mentioned, she's now at the women's team TIBCO, but she was at United Healthcare for many years, DSing for the men's and women's teams, and she did DS the men's team in Milan-San Remo in 2014, which of course is a World Tour event. So, Sherry Pridham, not the first female to be a sports director in a World Tour event, but the first to be employed by a World Tour team. That's a distinction. Lionel, we heard from a couple of your neighbours there. Nice for you to be able to do some interviews without leaving your village.
Well, yes, indeed, it was. Well, one of them was done on the phone, as you've probably been able to tell. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I wandered up to the bike shop and had a chat with James Millard and wandered back.
Who can you interview from your village for next week's podcast?
Good question. I don't think anyone else here is really relevant to the world of professional cycling.
It doesn't matter. We, you know, interminable interviews is what we're after.
I can do plenty.
Thanks, Bob.
Can deliver plenty.
I mean, Bob,
of those.
Your tweet didn't sting at all, honestly. but it did. Just, you know, it was a particularly long episode last week, so we're trying to make it a bit shorter. Give us your feedback though on that. Do you prefer, especially in the off season when we're only doing one a week, do you prefer a longer episode or a shorter episode? Let us know. It's good to take that kind of constructive feedback on board, isn't it? But we should wrap things up for this week, shouldn't we, chaps? We've got a special episode for next week. It'll really transport people back to a particular place and time in the cycling podcast year, we hope. And, well, it sort of ties in with a recent news story as well, doesn't it, involving the BBC. But not say any more than that. It'll be next week's Christmas special. Are we in the Christmas mood, Daniel?
Oh, very much so, Richard. I'm a very festive kind of guy, as you can imagine. Yep, I'll be draping myself in tinsel and bringing a Christmas cracker to next week's episode.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Until then, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard.